Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, Episode 8, Test Patterns and Video Setup with Stacey Spears and Don Munsell. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here of UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. This week's Geeks of the Week are Stacey Spears and Don Munsell, creators of the HD Benchmark Setup and Test Disc, which I'm really looking forward to talking with them about. Hey guys, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks very much.
We should let everyone know, the first Home Theater Geeks podcast with two guests. So those of you who are watching the live video stream should be able to see them at some point or another. But in any event, we should have a nice three-way conversation here. Let's start with HD Benchmark. You guys got together and put this setup and test this together. Which is already becoming a standard, certainly in my review kit, and I know most of the TV reviewers that I know are using it. What led you to come up with, to decide to make a new test disc? There are plenty of good ones out there already. Why make your own?
I think I'll let Stacey take that one, at least to start with, although we might take issue with that there's plenty of good test discs.
Ah, very good. Right, okay, fine. Let's take issue with that.
I think
that.
There's Don't just one. There's just one.
Hopefully none of the others are listening
right now. There's one good one out there.
No, that's not true. Actually, to be serious, we do actually like and use a lot of the other test discs, but obviously we think we could add something more. Mm-hmm. That we felt like we had some ideas for patterns that nobody else was doing. And, you know, there's some little quirks that we wanted to get around in some of the other test discs that are out there.
But can you give me some examples?
Stacey, you want to...
Well, so one of the things I wanted to say was a few years ago, you know, we're both friends with Guy Kuo, the author of Avia, as well as Joe Kane, the author of Video Essentials and Digital Video Essentials. Yep. And over the years, I kept asking him to add certain features, and neither one of them really did. So I wanted a disc that had everything I wanted on it. Mm. Like, one of the discs that became popular was the HQV disc, but it only focused on deinterlacing tests or tests that would show off their technology. No real calibration patterns. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to tie that in with calibration patterns and try to, like, as Don said, offer something new and different.
Mm-hmm.
And something easier to navigate.
Like, one of the things that that our disc has that I don't think anybody else has, in fact, I'm positive that nobody else does, is a workable chroma alignment pattern, so mm-hmm. that you can see whether the chroma is aligned with the luma channel. This is a pattern that we developed, and I think it works really well. You get at least half pixel accuracy, and it's not too hard if you know what you're doing to get more in a quarter pixel or less accuracy with it. And
now what does this pattern show us exactly?
It shows you if the chroma channel is aligned with the luma channel. So I'm assuming, I don't know, should I assume your audience is familiar with the fact that video has both a luminance and a chroma channel. And the chroma channel is really two channels. There's three channels in component video. Chroma channel, luminance channel, usually abbreviated Y, and then
which is the black and white information, the black to white and all the grays in between.
That's right. Black, white, and gray is in the luminance channel. Mm. And the chrominance channels are CB and CR, and those are effectively a scaled blue minus Y and red minus Y channels. So they effectively represent the luminance channel is effectively representing the brightness of a pixel,
right?
Pretty close to it. And the chrominance channel tell you the color of that pixel, like what's the hue of it, or how does it deviate from white or gray.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, you really need the chrominance channels to show up on the screen at the same locations as they're supposed to. You know, the pixels, if you shift the chroma channel relative to the luma channel, then you end up with color in the wrong places. You end up with colored fringes on things and so forth.
What do you mean shift the channel? I mean, fixed pixel devices have these pixels in fixed locations, thus their name, fixed pixel.
You'd like to think so, wouldn't you? Wouldn't that
but
be
it's not
great?
True.
It's not. Well, these devices are RGB devices. So for each pixel,
and we're talking
you have
about displays here, right?
A display. All displays are RGB devices.
Right. They ultimately need to deal with information about red, green, and blue.
That's correct. So mainly for compression, there's a whole host of technical reasons why this was done. The red, green, and blue channels are converted into this Y, CB, and CR channel. And that would be fine. If every pixel had a Y and CB and CR value, you just run the mathematics to convert it back to RGB, and every pixel would be back to its original color or some close, you know, rendition thereof, modulo compression artifacts and so forth. But that's not, in fact, what happens. In all of the delivery formats that, you know, we use today, the CB and CR channels are cut in half in both directions in resolution. So they are one quarter the total number of pixels.
Hmm.
And in addition, there's a very specific arrangement, which is actually somewhat mathematically hard to do correctly, where the pixels, where the chroma pixels are supposed to be located. Essentially, they aren't co-located on luma pixels, which is kind of, I think, what most people's mental image is that you just kind of throw away half the pixels in both directions, but leave in place the original chroma values from one quarter of the pixels. That's not the way it works. In fact, in MPEG-2, the pixels are co-located in the horizontal direction, but the chroma pixels are located conceptually in between the luma pixels, in between scan lines in the vertical direction.
Why is that?
Well, essentially, it's more mathematically correct. The most mathematically correct way to do it would be with the way MPEG-1 did it, where you actually have the chroma channel conceptually located in between the luma channels. So if you imagine a 2x2 block of pixels, right? So you've just got one little tiny square in the corner of the screen. So you're going to cut the chroma in half. So you can choose to say, well, I'll throw away three of the chroma pixel chroma information for three of those pixels. So let's say I'm just going to take the upper left and I'll leave that chroma alone, and then the other chroma I'll just throw away. Then when we display it later, we'll interpolate new chroma for those pixels. That would be one way of doing it. That is not the way anybody actually does it.
Okay.
A better way to do would be to average all of the chroma information for those four pixels and store that average number and say, well, overall, this 2x2 little bunch of pixels is roughly green. That's the bottom line is it's pretty much green. You know, we'll just average all that color information and say the average color of this area of the screen is green. Mm-hmm. And then when we come back and generate the RGB values, we'll reinterpolate that green value by looking at adjacent color values and so forth. Or we'll just copy green to all four of these pixels and we'll just have one quarter the chroma resolution, and it'll get interpolated as colored blocks. That's called nearest neighbor sampling.
Okay.
So probably the best from the standpoint of, you know, color imaging is that method that I mentioned. You just average all four pixels together and you say, okay, we'll store that value. Conceptually speaking, it's as though you're storing a sample that is in the middle, position-wise, of the 2x2 block.
Okay. So it's this conceptual pixel sitting at the boundary of the four pixels that we're talking about.
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
So for MPEG-1, that is exactly the way it works. In fact, for every 2x2 chunk of luma pixels, you have one chroma pixel, in a sense, that is conceptually in the middle, at the boundaries of those four pixels.
Right, at the crossroads, if you will.
Yes, exactly. For MPEG-2, they decided to move that virtual position horizontally 1.5 pixel to the left. So it now sits between the two Luma pixels vertically, mm-hmm. but at the same position as them as they are horizontally. The reasoning behind this right. was that horizontal chroma transitions are really important, and they wanted to make sure that horizontal chroma edges occurred at the same place on screen as horizontal Luma edges. Does that make sense?
It does. But why is the horizontal chroma boundary more important than the vertical?
That's a really good question. Because they could have decided to just, you know, do what I mentioned earlier and move it all to the upper left-hand corner.
Right.
I can only assume that it was some kind of bizarre compromise where there were the people who said, no, it should be co-located, and the other people saying, no, it should be, you know, in between. And they're like, all right, we'll co-locate it horizontally, but we'll do it in between vertically.
And you can imagine the arguments at the MPEG meeting.
Exactly. Well, these meetings, you know, I think before I got involved in video, I imagined that these standards meetings would be a lot of, you know, scientists kind of maybe even wearing white lab coats, you know, all sitting around.
Pocket protectors.
the technical merits of this whatever scheme there. But it's not like that at all. It is a bit like that. I mean, the people involved are generally engineers and so forth. But there's a lot of politics and commerce involved. There's, you know, Sony will say, well, we have a patent on X, so it's very important that the standard contain X so we can get some patent revenue. So they will lean on people, and I don't mean to pick on Sony. I mean, all the people sure. involved in the standards organization do this. And this is true of all standards, is that some different companies that have different technologies lobby to have their technology included in the standard so that they can get some patent royalty and or they can be ahead of the game on you know, they have all this technology, they have the understanding of it, everybody will have to come to them to learn about it, to use their technology, to license their technology, to, you know, pay them for the privilege of understanding how to use this properly. So this has been true with MPEG 1, MPEG 2, MPEG 4, you know, all of the different technologies have been involved, a lot of lobbying from different sides. Mm-hmm. So that all of this comes back to the point that because of this odd positioning issue, almost every chip and implementation of MPEG 2 decoding positions the chroma a little bit differently. Because they may choose to use the cheapest, simplest, most obvious algorithm, which is usually to just pretend that the chroma is up in the upper left corner. That's the simplest. It's just to say, well, even though it's supposed to be kind of midway between the first and second scan lines and then co-located, let's just put it in the upper left corner. Others decide to basically interpolate it as though it was MPEG 1. And they'll put the effective position of the chroma in the center between right. all the pixels. Others kind of vary depending on whether it's progressive, interlaced, depending on, I don't know, sunspot activity. It's very hard to tell. Go ahead.
I was going to say, it's worth pointing out that all your Blu-ray and DVD players are going to upsample the vertical, so the vertical's taken care of. It's the display or player that where the horizontal comes into effect.
So out of a player, the information is stored on the disc, actually, as I understand it, with one of the chroma channels even more compressed than what we're talking about.
No, they're equally compressed.
Oh, they're equally compressed? Yeah. I thought it was 420.
Yeah. Well, it is, but they're both a quarter the resolution of the Luma channel.
I see. Okay.
So 420 in itself is kind of a misnomer.
Let's talk about that for a second then, because I want to make sure everybody understands this term 420, 422, and 444, which geeks certainly encounter in their travels around the video world. One of you want to give us a little brief rundown on those terms?
Sure. 422 means that... let me tell you what it means, and then I can talk a little bit about the nomenclature, because the nomenclature is really hard to understand.
Okay.
But what it means is 422 means that there is one line of chroma information for every scan line of Luma information. So the chroma has not been subsampled or scaled vertically at all. It is the same vertically, but it has been scaled horizontally.
So there's half as much information in each of those channels horizontally,
right,
but not vertically.
But not vertically. 420 means that there is half as much information horizontally and also half as much information vertically, so a total of a quarter as much information. Essentially,
I gotcha.
Conceptually, you can just imagine that the chroma channel has been scaled to one quarter, one half its original size in both dimensions, so one quarter the number of pixels. So
right,
like a 1920 by 1080 full HD image, the chroma channels are actually 960 by 540.
Ah.
And then in 420, they would be 960 by 1080.
No,
the other way around.
Yeah. 422, they would be 960 by 1080. And 420, yes, they'd be 960 by 540.
Did I say that the wrong way around?
You said it the other
way around, yeah.
Yeah, 420 means that they're 960 by 540, and 422 means that they're 960 by 1080. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if it was 444, they'd be 1920 by 1080.
All right, of them.
The 444 means the chroma channels have the same amount of resolution as the Luma channel.
And the reason we don't use 444 to store stuff on the disk or to... or in component, typically, is because of storage requirements, bandwidth requirements.
Yeah, the chroma subsampling is like a cheap form of compression. It's like the first pass compression. It was originally constructed largely because engineers were trying to make color television compatible with black and white television. Black and white television just sent out one channel, a brightness channel, you know, the black and white channel. And they needed to add more channels. They needed the original plans were to send out a separate R, G, and B channel, right? That would be the most straightforward and obvious thing. You know, the displays are RGB, the cameras are RGB, so let's just send out R, G, and B.
Right.
That was problematic because now you need three full-resolution channels to send your picture. And if you cut the resolution of any one of the channels, it starts to look pretty sad. You can actually cut blue. Blue isn't too bad. The other thing is that the FCC said, you know, you need to make it compatible. Everybody who's bought a TV, it's got to still work. And you've got to piggyback it on the existing channel. So they had to figure out a way to take a color image and turn it into a black and white image plus some extra data, which a color TV could pay attention to and generate a color image.
Mm-hmm.
So a black and white TV would just look at one channel, a color TV would look at the other two channels. And they needed a way to make it completely backward compatible so that everyone who already owned a black and white TV could tune in the color signal and see a black and white image. And that's where YCBCR came from. Or it was, at that point, it was YUV or YIQ. These are all different versions of essentially the same idea. Take a black and white signal plus two color difference signals and broadcast them. And then the color difference signals, because they had so little bandwidth available, they'd filled up the bandwidth of the channel with a black and white signal. They had almost nothing to work with. They figured out a really clever way of shoehorning this very low resolution color signal in the spare empty bandwidth of the black and white signal.
Of which there wasn't much.
There wasn't much. So broadcast TV has very low chroma resolution, but it does actually have chroma for every scan line. So the chroma on broadcast TV is not vertically subsampled at all, or at least it wasn't in the analog era. Mm-hmm. In the digital era, it is, of course, subsampled. They're using 420, but that was the original genesis of this YUV or YCBCR system, was the necessity of shoehorning these extra color channels.
So it's a legacy that we're left with even in the digital age and even with massive amounts of storage like on Blu-ray and so on.
Right. In fact, if you were going to go to 444, there's actually not much reason to store it in YCBCR. If you're going to store full resolution, you might as well just store it as RGB.
Mm-hmm.
So there isn't that much reason to have YCBCR 444 other than it makes the signal processing chain a little more straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
In professional video, video is almost always stored 422 because that's considered good enough. It's considered easy to work with and good enough. Very few people store 444. Mm-hmm. It's much more likely that people would store something like a RAW format, like from these new digital cinema cameras. They'll store a RAW format, which is effectively an RGB format.
Right.
Or they're, you know, but digital master tapes and digital masters, digital master information just moved around a TV studio is typically 422.
Mm-hmm.
Uncompressed.
Right, but once you do that, once you subsample the chroma, as you call it, and by subsample we mean reduce its resolution,
right?
You can't really recover it precisely. You have to interpolate or somehow get it back by trickery. The actual original information is gone forever, right?
That's correct. Yes. And when you recreate it, you have to pay attention to the mathematics you use and how you interpolate it so that all the chroma edges coincide with the luma edges. And that's where
this gets us right back to our pattern.
Right. So in practice, what we find is that you do actually see chroma alignment issues. They're relatively common. And I think one of the reasons that they're relatively common is that it was very hard to see them. You know, you needed a test pattern that would make it clear what the chroma alignment was and where the problems were. Now, on the one hand, that suggests that maybe a chroma alignment problem is relatively small as these things go. You know, there's people every day watching their television with a half pixel chroma shift and not really noticing it because, you know, you're talking about a half pixel shift in the chroma channel. It's
if you're
visible,
sitting the right distance
there.
Away from the TV, you shouldn't be able to see individual pixels anyway.
Right. That's right. But in fact, if it's a really bright chroma, if it's, say, a bright red or something like that, and depending on the specifics, there are images where you can see it at normal viewing distances, but you'd have no idea that this was because your player wasn't doing the chroma upsampling correctly. And this is what, you know, what this whole disc is about is, and why we built the Progressive Scan Shootout for Secrets of Home Theater. Am I allowed to? I guess I already did. But
already did. Why not?
We wanted a benchmark that showed the, you know, that cast light, that shone light on problems with deinterlacing, with chroma upsampling, with processing in general. It's funny. A lot of errors that people would never accept in audio, somehow they'll accept them in video, and that's it's kind of an oddity. Like people get really obsessive about getting exactly their audio just perfect, and some of the same people will watch video with serious visual flaws. And one of the things that we feel like is that audio, there's a pretty robust ways of measuring audio. Audio is well understood. It's not that audio, there's not room for improvement and there's not a lot of sophistication with audio. It's that audio is relatively straightforward to measure. And so engineers have done a pretty good job of getting audio right. Video, it's actually hard to measure these little things like a half pixel chroma shift or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so there's not as much pressure for video companies to get it right. I think in some cases they know that they're doing the math incorrectly.
Yeah.
And they sort of say, well, you know, what's close enough, half pixel, 1 pixel. We saw one DVD chipset, very common, you know, a really popular chipset from a major company that every time it was doing interlaced processing, the chroma channel would shift up by one whole scan line. It was just a bug. So you would actually see, it was off in the progressive case by half a pixel, and then it was off in the interlaced case by 1.5 pixels.
Wow.
Vertically. Now, that was just a mistake, but they didn't catch it. But with this chroma alignment pattern, you could see it right there on the screen and say, well, what do you know? This is a serious problem.
Wow.
And if you want to, I was going to say, if you want to see a real world example, if you want to see how the pattern works, if you have a Blu-ray player that will let you switch between 422, 444, and RGB, mm-hmm. and the Samsung front projector, you can actually see the problem. So if you send 422 into the Samsung, the Samsung's going to convert from 422 to 444, and mm-hmm. it does it using what Don called nearest neighbor, which it basically just copies the pixel to the left. Mm-hmm. And that'll actually result in a half a pixel delay. But if you send 444 in, the player's doing the conversion, and there's no delay at all.
Depending on the player. I mean, some players might have more of a problem with that, right?
But most of the players right now are doing pretty well on that particular test. But, you know, you could do it with the Oppo. You could do it with the Pioneer. Those mm-hmm. are the ones I've tested with. Or
right.
the PS3 doesn't let you select, but it does it correct.
Yeah, the projector you're talking about is the Samsung SPA900B, I believe it's called.
Yeah, both the 800 and the 900.
Right. These are the Joe Kane specials, as
yes,
it were.
So it's great when you send 444 in, just don't send 422 in. But now here's the funny part. If you have a video processor, for example, there's at least two of them that do this. If you send 422 in, it converts to 444 and everything's great. If you send mm-hmm. 444 in, it downsamples to 422, does its processing, and then converts back to 444, which gives you a big loss in chroma resolution.
No kidding.
Yeah.
This reminds me of the of some of the HD DVD players. You might have actually, Stacey, you might have actually told me about this originally. That
where it would, when you output 720p, it would go down to SD first, then back up to 720p.
Yeah, exactly. Or if you wanted to output even 1080p, it would first take the 1080p off the Blu-ray, or the HD DVD rather, change it to 1080i, interlace it, and then de-interlace it.
Yeah.
It's like, what are they thinking?
Well, in HD DVD's defense, it was actually, it's flagged as interlaced, so they kind of have to take it out as interlaced. Whereas Blu-ray is actually
I missed that. You said its flag was interlaced?
Yeah, HD DVD only allowed interlaced content at 1080. It all had to be 1080i.
They could use this
on the disc. The disc's defined output was 1080i. It's sort of like DVD's defined output is 480i.
Right.
So even though movies are often encoded on DVD using progressive MPEG pictures, the sequence is defined as interlaced. And so the
output has to come out of the player as interlaced or out off of the disc rather.
It's defined, the chip is supposed to produce an interlaced stream. Essentially, the chip, it reads the headers of the sequence, and it says, okay, this is an interlaced sequence. So the chip informs the outside world, okay, I'm getting ready to produce an interlaced sequence. Mm-hmm. And at that point, even though there are progressive frames being used, essentially for compression efficiency, the chip is supposed to, if it's following the spec, produce an interlaced sequence, mm-hmm. at which point you can then deinterlace it. There's a lot of progressive scan DVD players that just the chip is kind of non-compliant in an interesting way where it says, well, even though this sequence is marked as interlaced, I'm just going to kind of sniff ahead and look at the actual frames and say, oh, look, these frames are encoded as progressive. So I'll tell the outside world I'm going to produce a progressive sequence, or they're told that the chip is put into a progressive mode by the control firmware, and the chip says, well, whatever I see, I'm going to output progressive. So if I see progressive frames, then great. I'm in good shape. I'll just output progressive frames. If I don't see progressive frames on the disc, then it has to scramble around and do something. And typically what it does is some kind of god-awful deinterlacing that you would never want to watch in a million years. So these chips are great for dealing with movies that are all encoded with progressive frames. They tend to do a pretty lousy job with video content, content shot with a video camera, or stuff that was shot on film but isn't encoded with progressive frames on the disc.
Right.
It's a huge issue. Like, should you output interlace, then run it into a deinterlacer that analyzes the cadence and analyzes the image and generates progressive frames? I think the answer is pretty much yes for DVD, because you really can't trust the flags on the DVD on too many DVDs, you know. And it's I feel like if I want progressive scan DVD, I want it to work on everything. I want it to work on everything I own. I don't want it to just work well on the you know, best Hollywood movies. I want it to work well on low budget stuff that I buy and, you know,
independent stuff,
animation,
and
all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And who knows how they encoded it.
So HD DVD had essentially the same issue. The discs had to be encoded interlaced, even though they were allowed to use Progressive Pictures in the interlaced stream for compression efficiency.
Why was that? Why did HD DVD make that policy?
Well, because the table of formats for ATSC doesn't include 1080p 60.
True.
That's part of it. So
it
they
certainly
said,
includes 1080p 24, which is how most movies would be encoded onto the disc, right?
Yes, it does. Toshiba's feeling was there were very few displays that could handle 1080p 24 at that time. I can't speak for Toshiba. This is my interpretation of what happened.
Sure.
Toshiba said, you know what? Most of these televisions, all they can take is 1080i. So we should just encode the video as 1080i. That way the player can be simple. The player just outputs 1080i. Mm-hmm. Straightforward, simple. Sony's feeling was, well, you know, the native rate of these films is 24 frames a second, 24 frame progressive. So right. Let's encode the data at its native rate and then make the player smart enough to generate whatever format the television can handle. Mm-hmm. So if you have a Blu-ray player and you're attached to a television that can only handle 1080i, then the Blu-ray player generates the 3:2 pull down required, and it looks no worse than if you just encoded it at 1080i. In fact, it probably looks better.
Right.
And if your display can handle 24p, then it outputs 1080p 24. So Blu-ray, I think, is the better way to go.
I have to say I agree. I think Toshiba was not farsighted, shall we say, because, yes, okay, at the time, maybe most displays were limited to accepting 1080i, but that certainly wasn't going to be the case, indefinitely down the line. They had to know that they were probably working on TVs themselves that could easily accept 1080p 24.
Right. Well,
you would think so.
Sorry, Stacey, go ahead.
I was going to say, if we didn't really look forward, then there would be no 3D because there are no 3D displays today. Right. So then,
right, exactly.
Yeah.
Hey, I own a 3D display.
You
well,
do?
After a fashion. I have two projectors. I have two projectors and a silver screen and a bunch of
polarizing, you know,
3D
filters.
Glasses. I have actually had a 3D presentation of Spy Kids 3D in full color, full resolution in my home. Our club. I'm the president of a 3D camera club, so we do 3D projection every month at our club. So I'm the guy that holds on to the 3D projectors. So I have the 3D projectors in my house, so I can show 3D movies and do 3D projection and so forth.
Wow! I want to get into 3D deeply with you guys, but before we do, I wanted to just get back to a point, Don, that you made when we were speaking the other day about the value of test patterns. One of the things on HD Benchmark and all test discs for that matter are patterns and clips and various things that show you how well or how poorly your processor is doing its job. The processor in the TV, the processor in the player, perhaps an external processor, video processor, I mean. And you look at that. I mean, as a reviewer, I look at those patterns and I'm able to say in my review, oh, this TV's video processor is deinterlacing very well, or it's really not deinterlacing very well. But there's nothing you can do about it. And so the question came up that you raised, and I think rightly so. What can an end user do with that information? Because they can't go in and tweak the circuits in their TV, certainly.
Right. We get this question a lot, actually. Is, obviously with stuff like brightness, contrast, sharpness, and so forth, you can adjust those. That's calibration.
Right. I call it setup. I reserve the term calibration for what might more technically or completely be called grayscale calibration, which requires some pretty expensive equipment and some pretty significant training to be able to do well.
Right. Yes. Well, I would call it basic calibration, but yes.
Basic calibration as opposed to advanced calibration. Okay.
Right, right. I mean, calibration is just setting something relative to a known standard, and you know, that's what you're doing when you're setting your brightness and contrast and stuff.
Right.
But that's
besides the point. And you guys on the disc offer patterns that let people set those controls very well. In fact, when I do my reviews, I use your disc typically to set those values.
Yeah. So that's obvious. You know, that's a big win where you can set the controls on your television correctly. So then you say, well, what about deinterlacing? If my television has a terrible deinterlacer, why do I want to look at these deinterlacing clips and just find it? Why do I even want to find out?
It's just going to make me feel bad, man.
Yeah, exactly. Well, part of it is that more and more people, certainly Stacy and I mean, as Stacy alluded, we kind of build the disc we would want, and we hope that other people will find it useful as well. Mm-hmm. We often have multiple ways of deinterlacing, and in fact, lots of people do these days. If you have a player that outputs 1080p, then it has a deinterlacer in it, right? Because if you put in a DVD or you put in a 1080i disc, it's got to generate 1080p, so it has a deinterlacer in it. Right. And then if you have a video processor, that has
some sort of external box,
right? And your display certainly has a deinterlacer in it. So there's three devices. Like in my rack, and I don't have that complicated a rack, but I have an Oppo Blu-ray player, I have a DVD-O Edge video processor, and I have a projector. All three of those have a deinterlacer in them. So the deinterlacing clips can help you decide what format should I output from which devices. Because by changing the input and output formats on all these various devices, you can force the deinterlacing to occur in one or the other of these devices. And if you discover that perhaps your projector has the best deinterlacing, you know, maybe it's got a really good deinterlacing chip in it, you may decide to input 1080i into that projector when you're viewing 1080i content. And you may be able to, you know, your player may, in fact, be able to set, you could set it to like Source Direct or something along those lines, where it can be outputting exactly whatever format is on the disc. So you get interlaced if it's interlaced on the disc, or progressive if it's progressive on the disc. Or you might find out that the player does a better job of deinterlacing. So in that case, you want to force the player to output progressive, so you make sure that the player always does the deinterlacing. So with our disc, you can answer those questions. You also might find out, for example, that your resolution or your chroma resolution or your chroma delay changes. As Stacy mentioned earlier, with certain displays, if you feed them 422, they do slightly different things than if you do 444. He didn't also mention that some displays reduce the chroma resolution. Like the visible chroma resolution goes down if you feed them certain formats. So,
and the only way to know that, I guess, is to try these different settings using some of the patterns that are on your disc.
That's right.
Exactly.
I mean, and yeah. So each of these patterns has a reason for existence. Like, it's not just thrown on there to make the disc, you know, to pad the disc out to a specific size. Like, we use these patterns. So and of course, it also is helpful if you're thinking about buying a new piece of equipment, or if you're wondering, you know, does this piece of equipment work as well as I think it does, or is there a problem with this piece of equipment? Certainly, it's helpful if you're trying to review a piece of equipment. You know,
it's great help to me, obviously, yeah.
Sure. Reviewers, obviously, it's great. But if you're thinking about a new piece of equipment and you want to, you know, take the disc down to the store and say, can I put in this disc and play it? I find that I've never been to a store where they said, no, you can't play a disc that you brought in from outside. You know, I don't know. Maybe they'll figure out that this is what's going on, and they'll start saying, no, I'm sorry. You can only watch Star Wars and The Fifth Element. That's all we allow here at this store. But if you can put this in and watch it on their wall of TVs and see what happens, you know, it's fascinating to watch and look around and see what are the differences. And, you know, it really helps. The whole point of test patterns is that they help you draw attention to the specific detail you're trying to measure, right? If you're trying to figure out which of these salamis is longer, you know, or something, you can just eyeball it, or you can get out a ruler. And the ruler is a tool that you use to find, you know, measure something. You know, you can get out calipers, you can get out tools, and that's all test patterns are, is a tool for measuring a specific thing. You can measure resolution, you can measure chroma delay, you can measure deinterlacing performance, you can measure all sorts of things. And so for each pattern, Stacy and I, you know, went back to first principles. What are we measuring? What is the best way to construct a pattern that will measure that one thing? And I think that not to diss anybody's discs, but it's not uncommon for people to put patterns on discs with numbers all over them and wedges and zone plates and stuff like that. And they're very, very handy if you're a professional video engineer who knows what all these things are for. You look at it and you say, oh, I've got colored blocks here. I've got diagonal wedges here. I've got, you know, all these different things all over it. It's got lines and boxes and squares and stuff. And we really, really, really wanted to avoid that as much as possible. There are some standard patterns on our disk, like the SMPTE color bars. We describe what that's for to the extent, you know, as much as possible. And we try to avoid using patterns where there's just like 85 different things on the pattern and you have no idea what all those are for. The idea is to focus on this pattern is for measuring this, and here's what you're looking for. Here's what you should see. Here's what you shouldn't see. If you are a professional video engineer, I think, you know, you can get even more out of it. There's some patterns where there's features or items on them that somebody who's really, really knowledgeable is going to get even more out of. But I think anyone can look at the patterns and look at our help with the, you know, right and wrong images and can get some idea of, does this look correct or does it not look correct?
Now, you to reinforce that point, you put on the disc some explanation of how to interpret these patterns, what to look for, and I guess some sort of still image of this. If it looks like, sort of like this, it's correct, and if it looks sort of like this, it's incorrect. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
And which is very helpful.
Yeah. In a few cases, there's about 18 different ways that could look wrong and only one way it could look right. So we couldn't put 18 different images, but we tried to put, you know, the most common problems in the help text. So at least at least you can see a correct image on the screen. And those correct images, like when we're in the brightness pattern, there's some interesting things about those correct images. The correct images are actually themselves incorrect in some sense.
What?
Like when we're, like with the brightness pattern, we're trying to show you this is what it should look like, or the Plouge pattern, this is what it should look like. Well, to make sure you can see what it looks like, that right wrong image has an elevated brightness. So that if your brightness is set incorrectly, you won't just see a black screen. You know, you'll actually see an image on the screen.
Right.
We deliberately, in some cases, make the demonstration image like a different brightness so that if your controls are set way off, you'll still be able to look at the help and see what it's supposed to look like.
Right.
I only mentioned that to say, don't use the help text images to calibrate with. Use the actual images, right. Right. Or, you know, don't email us and say, it looks right in the actual image, but when I put up the help, I don't know. You know, the brightness is all different.
Right.
That's intentional.
Now, I wanted to return for a moment to standards such as MPEG-2 and MPEG-4, which we've been talking about. The other common video compression standard is VC1, which was developed by Microsoft, where, in fact, both you guys work. And, Don, you used to work in the multimedia department. You don't anymore. Stacy, though, you still do, correct?
Sort of, but these days I don't actually work on multimedia itself.
Oh. What are you doing these days, then?
Right now we're going through a transition, so I should know shortly what I'll be working on.
Oh, did you work on developing VC1?
I worked on VC1 a few years ago. And since then, I've worked on sort of the next step of it's VC1, but we did some improvements for streaming video. So this last fall, the Xbox launched, you know, Zune HD on the Xbox. So you get 1080p instantly. And so we did It would work with any codec, but all our initial enhancements were done on top of VC1.
Mm-hmm. Now, VC1, having been developed by Microsoft, didn't have to go through that same sort of committee process, Don, that you were talking about earlier, right? I mean, it was developed by a single company. Now, it might have been a committee within the company, but you didn't have to worry about different, you know, Panasonic and Sony and all these other companies saying, hey, we want to have our thing in there.
No, but once it actually became a standard to actually go right. through the standard process, all these companies provided feedback. And some of them said, you know what? We think that's our technology. And others said, we think that's ours. That's why if you look at the VC1 patent pool, it's made up of multiple companies.
Part of the issue is, go ahead, Stacey.
If you were to go to a desert island and you knew nothing about compression and you built a brand new codec, chances are you're using something that someone else has patented already.
Nothing new under the sun, huh?
It's a patent minefield out there. You pretty much can't do video compression without stepping on somebody's patent. Wow. Even if you invented everything yourself, it's just there's so many basic principles that are patented right now. Mm-hmm. That it's pretty hard to make any kind of codec without hitting patent issues. And then also during the SMPTE process, there was some other stuff added, nothing really major as far as technology-wise, but there were some changes made to the format to allow for extra metadata and some other stuff. So the differences between VC1 and Windows... WMV9, you know, the Windows Media Video 9.
Which was where VC1 came from?
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Microsoft had already shipped WMV9 encoder and decoder. And then when it was submitted to SMPTE for standardization, and SMPTE retitled it VC1, but it actually is a little bit different. It's close enough that a WMV9 decoder could be adjusted slightly to handle VC1 without much trouble. Mm-hmm. And VC1, the underlying technology, is essentially the same.
Well, they did change the interlace codec. Originally, the interlace codec was 411, but due to overwhelming pressure, we created a 420 interlace codec to match MPEG-2 and AVC using the same chroma co-siting. Same chroma co-siting, the way chroma is laid out.
Oh, same chroma location relative to the luma.
I see. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Stacy, you mentioned a moment ago online content delivery. And so I wanted to just take a moment to talk with you guys about that, because it's obviously a huge thing that's going to get even huger in the future. But I myself have a hard time with it because it never really matches the quality of Blu-ray.
And I don't think it ever will. So when they do a Blu-ray, you know, it's first done encoded by a machine, and then an operator comes along and hand tunes it.
Yeah.
And they actually spend a lot of time doing a Blu-ray disc. For all the streaming stuff, it's completely automated. And there is no hand tuning, because you've also got lower bit rates. You've got just a lot more constraints.
Right.
And so you just set your expectations lower. So unless the compression gets a lot better or the pipes get a lot bigger, it's always going to be, I think, inferior to optical disc.
Mm-hmm. I think it's possible in the future that network bandwidth will get to the point where you can essentially stream a Blu-ray over the internet. And at that point, there's no reason why it couldn't be just as good.
Sure.
But in practice right now, the bit rates are not the same. The bit rates are not even close. You know, the bit rates on Blu-ray are really high, and the bit rates on streaming video, HD video, are much, much lower. Now, whether or not your average consumer is going to notice the difference is a whole other question.
It is another question. It is related to the question of how MP3 audio became so popular, even though it's quite a bit lower bit rate, lower quality in the case of high compression than even CD, much less DVD audio and SACD, which of course sort of bit the dust soon after they tried to battle it out, and both lost to MP3, indicating to me that convenience won out over quality.
Well, I think it's also harder to see compression. I think it's harder to hear compression artifacts than to see them.
That's a good point.
It probably depends on the artifact, but yeah. I think the other thing is that at high enough bitrate, MP3 actually does sound, practically speaking, as good as CD. Mm-hmm. I know that there's all kinds of differences of opinion on this, and I don't want to get into a big, you know, hullabaloo about it, but
right, sure.
In general, lossy compression works. I mean, Dolby bragged that they could demonstrate absolute transparency. Like, people could not tell the difference between an uncompressed soundtrack in 5.1 and a Dolby Digital soundtrack in 5.1 at a pretty low bit rate, mm-hmm. substantially lower than the original soundtrack. Mm-hmm. And, you know, AC3 is not some super amazingly perfect codec. It's a very good codec, you know, but it is a lossy codec.
Sure.
And the plain truth is, you know, uncompressed audio is storing things that you can't hear. You cannot hear. It's in there's right. stuff that's in there that you are not actually able to hear.
Right.
So it is kind of a waste of bits in some sense. I understand the argument for keeping uncompressed audio, largely because you know, do you really trust that these lossy codecs are throwing away just the right stuff, just the right. stuff that you can't hear, and none of the stuff that you can hear?
I don't necessarily trust them for that.
yeah. But on the other hand, if I'm listening to Lady Gaga, I really don't care if it's MP3 or CD. I guess.
Oh, I suppose.
It depends on what I'm listening to. If I'm trying to listen to Charlie Parker, I want the best quality I can.
Right.
But, you know, I don't know. Popular music. I can't win. I gotta get out of this hole.
I like Lady Gaga, so.
I'm sorry, Stacey, what was that?
I said I enjoy Lady Gaga, so.
Oh, well, there you go. Okay.
I dislike Lady Gaga. I have no problem with Lady Gaga.
Speaking of Lady Gaga, did you guys watch the Grammys last night?
I've watched a little. It's sitting on the TiVo.
Yes.
Oh, so one thing though about streaming video, sorry.
Oh yeah, sure. Let's finish that up. Absolutely.
Well, is a lot of it you're watching today on your computer. So if you're watching it on a small monitor or in a small window, the compression doesn't look too bad.
That's a good point. Once you blow it up
on a big screen. So I think the Netflix seems to be everywhere now on televisions, Blu-ray players, Xboxes, PS3s.
Sure.
So.
Yep, you're exactly right. And if there is a trend, I'm sure, to watch content on a computer screen, which is quite a bit smaller than a home theater screen, and those artifacts and problems aren't going to be nearly as visible. That's a very good point to make, which is another reason,
of course,
probably why I don't like online video that much, because I don't watch on a computer. I watch on a big screen.
Another thing with video compression. You know, with Blu-ray, you might be hitting, say, 20 megabits, you know, as your Stacey knows the actual numbers on this. Stacey, is that about right? 20 megabits would be a reasonable average bit rate for Blu-ray.
So on a high profile A title, say a Pixar title, it'll be about 20 average, 30 peak. On mm-hmm. a lower budget title, you'll actually have a higher peak. And the reason is on these, you know, Pixar movies, for example, they like to put a lot of extras. So the extras take up disk space. So you've got to, you know, cut corners somewhere. Or they mm-hmm. might put multiple lossless audio soundtracks. So all that takes away from your peak. But yeah, 20 average, 30 peak is pretty common.
Right. Mm-hmm. So if you take that video and recompress it at, let's say, something horribly, you know, tons smaller, same codec, take it to like, oh, let's say 3 megabits average and 6 or 7 peak, right? Mm-hmm. During a continuous scene without a lot of motion, you know, people standing around talking or a little bit of, you know, maybe a little bit of moving, it'll look fine. You know, there may be some small differences with a 20 megabit, but it's not going to be wildly obvious. It's when
sure.
things start moving a lot, when you've got a lot of pans, if you have flashes, if you have cuts, it's like every time there's a dissolve, you'll see the whole screen break up into squares.
Right.
And you see that all the time. And when they're encoding a movie, they can't have that. They can't have the screen breaking up into squares. Like, they're pretty picky about this stuff. So they need sure. the bit rates to be high enough to make sure that every frame of the film looks really, really good. Their standards mm-hmm. are very high. A lot of consumers, apparently, it appears that the marketplace has said that as long as most of the time the movie looks pretty good, if every once in a while it turns into square vision, this is apparently acceptable if it only happens on a dissolve or a fast motion sequence. You know, like mm-hmm. I was watching the Grammys, during Lady Gaga coming out at the beginning. There were strobes. There was confetti flying everywhere. It was a compression nightmare.
Yeah,
and I was watching full bitrate, you know, so I was watching about something that was probably at about 18 megabits per second for video. This is MPEG-2, obviously, but it could not keep up. It turned into square vision really, really quickly.
Yeah.
And yet, most of the time, 18 megabit MPEG-2 looks pretty darn good. But there are times when it just cannot keep up, especially when they're encoding it live. And so that's which
they were doing for the Grammys, for example.
Right, right.
Now, were you watching over the air or was it coming through Fios? I know you have Fios.
Yeah, it's coming through Fios, but I've already verified that Fios is not changing the bit rate. So it is effectively the over the air signal. They just they just pack it onto the fiber optic. It's remuxed, but it's not re-encoded.
Right. Right. Did you see the little 3D thing with Michael Jackson?
I haven't seen it yet. Again, it's on the TiVo.
Yeah.
Was it any good?
I'm not a fan of Anaglyph. And for those who may not have seen it, it was broadcast in what's called Anaglyph using the red cyan glasses that many people are very familiar with. I know, Don, you are as well. I don't like looking through those glasses. It's kind of a drag. It did give you a 3D effect. The biggest problem I had was that they kept switching between the movie, which is in 3D, and they encoded it with this Anaglyph, yellow or red cyan, and it kept switching between that and the performers on stage in 2D in high def, but not with Anaglyph. And yet there were a couple of shots. I know that they did have one 3D camera, an Ikigami 3D camera, that they had in the hall, and occasionally there was a shot of one of the celebrities that was singing along with Michael Jackson that was, in fact, in Anaglyph. So going back and forth between this 3D and 2D during the segment that was supposed to be 3D after they said, put on your 3D glasses now, that was kind of disconcerting. So I was kind of disappointed, to tell you the truth.
Well, you know, that's 3D. I mean, I don't know. I've been working with 3D for quite a few years now. And when you look at the history of 3D, it just always seems like the thing that kills 3D is that people get very excited about it. And then you get a lot of crap in 3D.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's true of a lot of all different mediums. You know, when color film became cheaper, you know, crappy film started shooting in color. Well, that really didn't give anybody a headache or anything. They were still just as crappy. They were just now in color. But in 3D, if you make mistakes in 3D, it gives the audience a headache.
Yes.
And that's a real problem. Right?
Serious problem.
Like, there's this movie which looks like a perfectly nice, you know, a family movie. And I really applaud the makers of this. I'm sure it was very difficult to get this made, called Call of the Wild 3D. And it has Christopher Lloyd in it. And it's this film shot in Alaska or shot in Montana to look like Alaska, but lots of snow and dog sledding and stuff like that. And the 3D is just really problematic from a just visual headache point of view. Like, there's a lot of shots that have really problematic, they're very difficult to view for a lot of technical reasons. 3D has these technical requirements that mean if you do it wrong, people are really not going to like it. If it's done right, if it's done well, then it's a really nice immersive experience that lots of people would enjoy. But if you do it wrong, you can just turn people off 3D forever, and people walk out of the theater saying, I don't want to watch 3D movies. They give me a headache.
Right, right.
I think it's in the 50s when 3D enjoyed a brief, you know, heyday, and then it also had a very short heyday in the 70s as well. This happened very quickly because there were a lot more different ways to screw it up. These modern 3D projection systems, like, you can be sure that with minimal effort, you can get the projection to be right. Without any obvious misalignment of the two projectors. Because if you misalign the projectors, if you're using two projectors, it's a guaranteed headache no matter how good the film is.
Right.
If the projectors are aligned properly, then it's just a matter of how good is the film. So at least we can be sure that if the film is good, then probably the projectors are aligned properly, and at least, you know, you should get a decent 3D experience in that way. And in general, the 3D movies that I've seen in the modern era, like the Pixar 3D movies and Monsters vs. Aliens and Bolt and things like that, have been really well done. Avatar. Yeah, I think they're much less likely to provoke headaches than the movies in the 50s, because you had so many different ways that the movies could be badly aligned. The cameras could be improperly aligned when they were shooting it. They could shoot it with all wrong settings for the camera interocular. They could then project it with the projectors mismatched. The frames could get out of sync because you could have a clip edited out of the middle of one eye's view, but not the other. And now for the rest of the film, you're watching totally mismatched frames on the left and right. This happened.
Oh, man.
It doesn't happen now with digital projection. You know, you don't end up with like frames missing just from the left side or just from the right side. So I think it's more likely that 3D is going to stick around this time. But I do worry every time somebody produces a film that's got all these, you know, poke you in the eye effects, you know.
Which even Avatar had one or two of those.
Yeah, well, you know, you can't. There's a guy who was the 3D coordinator for DreamWorks and some other companies, and he was saying that, you know, he's worked in 3D for years, and he said that the artists always want to just tell a good story and make it 3D, make the 3D compelling and interesting and good looking and just tell a nice story. And the producers always want to poke the audience in the eye. The producers are like, what is this? We're paying all this money for 3D and you're not poking me in the eye. Come on.
Come on.
Somebody pick up a stick and poke it at the camera.
Stacy, what experience do you have with 3D? Are you working on anything in that regard, or you like it or hate it, or what's your feeling about it?
Well, Don and I have been brainstorming on how you could evaluate 3D displays, for example.
Ah, a 3D HD benchmark. I like it.
Damn.
So the question is, now we've got to wait on... Well, now we've got to wait on encoders. We've got to wait on authoring software. When I spoke to Panasonic last year in November, they were pretty much already booked for all of this year with just Warner, Disney, and DreamWorks.
Wow.
So, and they were the only ones at the time capable of actually doing 3D. So it'll be interesting.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, Don and I, pretty much all we've been doing right now is just brainstorming. You know, what can you do? What are the different 3D display technologies that are going to be out there?
And how can we evaluate? There are several.
Yeah.
And have you been taking I lent Stacy one of my 3D cameras. Have you been taking it out? Have you done anything with it?
No, not yet.
Oh, one of the big questions that I've had for a long time, and you guys might be the perfect guys to answer it, or at least investigate it, is how does one define resolution in 3D? Because not only do you have, you know, the horizontal by vertical, but now you also have depth. And certainly I've seen a lot of cases where fast motion on a 3D program is very blurry or stuttery. So this is a big question that I don't understand quite how to answer. Any comments there?
Well, I think it's really just the resolution of the individual eye views, but there are some quirks about 3D where you can imagine that a 3D display that has full resolution for each eye still could look worse than a 2D display of exactly the same specs, the same resolution. For example, 3D, almost every 3D technology that is out there cuts the light in half. For obvious reasons. You're directing half the light to one eye, half the light to the other eye. So
and you've got these glasses that filter out a bunch of light.
Right. They also add, almost all the shutter glasses systems add flicker, and the passive glasses systems that are being designed for the home right now, mm-hmm. Reduce the vertical resolution. So the passive glasses systems, typically what they do is every other scan line is polarized oppositely. So right. Usually these days it's circular. So one line is polarized clockwise, the next line is polarized counterclockwise, clockwise, counterclockwise, and so forth, all the way down right. the screen. Right. You put on some passive glasses that are circular polarized, just like the Real D glasses in the cinema. In fact, you can use right. Real D glasses. At home, every other scan line goes to every other eye. So your left eye is seeing the even scan lines, and your right eye is seeing the odd scan lines. So obviously right. your resolution is cut in half, and your image has all these black lines in between every other scan line. That right. affects your perception of the image. And also, in a set, it cuts the light in half as well.
Yes, yes.
The shutter glasses approach, you know, you're seeing alternating images, left, right, left, right, left, right, and the shutter glasses synchronize. Right. And that, of course, cuts the light and adds this flicker. If the shutters are moving fast enough, you probably won't notice the flicker. And
I didn't see it very much in the demos I saw at CES, for example. Mm-hmm. And most of the companies at CES that were showing 3D were using shutter glasses, not passive, I assume, to get full resolution in each eye.
Right.
And I didn't... It is I, the, didn't,
I think sorry? LG had passive glasses.
Oh, they did. Okay. I know JVC has passive glasses on a relatively small LCD TV. That's like 46, 47 inches, something like that.
And it's $10,000.
And it's $10,000! They were also using passive glasses on their projector, on their projection system. And I don't remember who else was doing projected. Oh, Optima, I know, was doing projected 3D as well. And they were using passive as well.
And if you do passive glasses on a front projector, then you're going to need a silver screen.
Correct, which is going to affect all kinds of things.
Right.
And hot spotting is a big problem with them.
Yes.
Well, it's not a big problem. It's a problem.
now, boys.
As I say, as a man who owns 3 silver screens, so...
Well, because you're Mr. 3D, of course. You know, you've got do you have you ever had an active shutter glass system in your house? Projection system?
Not projection, no. I've never... Well, the thing is, for our club, shutter glasses are just not going to work because we got 50 people watching the screen. We're not going to buy 50 pairs of shutter glasses.
They're more expensive, that's the big thing.
Yeah, NVIDIA charges $150 a pair for spare pairs of shutter glasses for their system.
Wow, I didn't realize
some of the numbers I've heard thrown around are like $50 a pair or something along those lines for
even so
these consumer ones.
Right.
Yeah, that's a lot of money, and also most of them are rechargeable. What happens when your shutter glasses lose charge halfway through the movie?
Halfway through the movie, you're stuck.
Right.
Oh,
and so,
man.
Passive glasses.
It's time for a long bathroom break at that point.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, indeed.
You either have to plug them into the charger, or you've got to have some spare glasses that are always on the charger, or, you know, something like that.
Oh, even more.
Or use wired glasses and string wires all over your home theater. It's
just as we're going towards wireless audio and wireless video, for that matter. Now we're having 3D wires all over the all over the studio, all over the home theater.
There are ways of essentially combining the shutter glasses technology approach with a passive approach, where you essentially put a big like LCD shutter over the display, or you put an LCD shutter on the projector. In fact, some of these projection systems work that way, where Real D actually uses a single projector with mm-hmm. a kind of a shutter-like thing in front of the projector that's constantly switching the polarization of the light back and forth.
How and interesting.
Then, yeah, so with a silver screen. So
you still need to use a silver screen.
Right,
and we should tell everybody that the reason for that is that you need a screen that preserves the polarization of the light that's coming from the projector.
Right.
And that requires, I don't know anything other than it requires a silver screen. Now, there are plenty of silver screens out there. Is there anything else that's special about those polarization preserving silver screens?
Do you want the technical answer?
Sure. Hey, we're geeks here, man.
All right. We're all geeks here. We can learn. Specular reflections preserve polarization. A mirror, right? A mirror, yeah. Or a metal. A mirror preserves polarization because it's all specular reflection. Like metals.
Define specular reflection.
Specular reflection is a type of reflection. I'm not sure about the actual physics of it, but most materials have a specular component, which is the component that's like a mirror. It just reflects the light and it bounces right off, right?
Right.
If light is absorbed and re-emitted, then that is the diffuse reflection. That's then you see the color of the object. Specular reflection is always the color of the light. Mm-hmm. So, like glare on a windscreen or something is specular reflection, whereas when you look at like a piece of red cloth, that red is the diffuse reflection, right? A specular reflection is the color of the light that bounces off.
Gotcha.
So specular reflection preserves polarization. A white screen is all
diffuse reflection does not.
And diffuse reflection is not. A white screen is all diffuse reflection, which is great because light is spreading all over the place, right? So from any angle, you get lovely, good looking light.
Right.
Specular reflection is always angled. It bounces off at an angle and the polarization is preserved. So effectively, a silver screen is like a whole lot of little tiny mirrors. If you looked at it under a microscope, what you'd see is a whole lot of metal flakes at different angles. And each of those is like you're holding up a little shard of a mirror. So all the light that bounces off the screen is specular reflection, which is polarizing, which preserves polarization.
Right. So can any circular screen work like a Stuart Greyhawk or Firehawk? Or does it need to have some other special...
It needs to be silver. It needs to be metallic. So, no, a Greyhawk or Firehawk will not work. Actually, it's a little
gray. They're not silver.
Right. It needs to actually have a metallic surface that the light is bouncing off of. Mm-hmm. With certain brands of metallic silver paint, you can actually paint a wall metallic silver and that'll work. It was really easy in the 50s to do 3D because most theaters had a silver screen. Silver was the highest gain screen available.
Right. Everyone talks about, it's on the silver screen.
Right. The idea of the silver screen, yeah. So they didn't have very bright bulbs in the projector, so they needed the highest gain screen you could get, and that was a silver screen.
Right.
But over time, people made better and better matte white screens, which have better characteristics for lots of reasons, better color characteristic, less hot spotting, things like that.
Right. As Stacey pointed out earlier,
right. There is another system that doesn't require polarization and doesn't require active glasses, and that is Dolby's technology, which was licensed from Infinitec.
Right.
And it uses...
it's similar to Anaglyph, right?
It's not really Anaglyph. It uses notch filters, red, green, and blue notch filters layered in the glasses and on the projector so that each of the three color bands, red, green, and blue, are divided into two sub-bands. So you've got red high, red low, blue high, blue low, green high, green low, if you look at it on a spectral plot. And so you send all the left eye views through red, green, blue, low, those little notches.
Right.
And all the right eye views go through red, green, blue, high.
Right.
So you're essentially splitting up the spectrum into six pieces instead of three. And then your glasses, the right eye is just all the high frequency components of red, green, and blue. And the left eye is the low frequency components of red, green, and blue.
Yeah.
I finally saw a movie using this system at the Science Museum in Hartford, Connecticut. And it's really good. It really looks good. The only problem is that the glasses are like $25 a piece.
Oh,
and
they have little security sensors in them, just like a store does. So a lot of the theaters have little. As you walk out, if you're carrying the glasses with you, an alarm will go off.
Oh, really? That's actually how I saw Avatar. Was with the Dolby system.
And
think it looked pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. It's really a quite a good system. It doesn't require a silver screen. Mm-hmm. So that's nice. But
How do you get the... Do you need two projectors or how do you get the two images?
I think they either use two projectors or they use a special color wheel kind of a thing where they spin
that's
a wheel in front of the projector and synchronize it.
Yeah, the wheel goes between the lens and the sensor.
That's
on a single projector.
So it's interesting that it's almost back to single chip DLP.
Right. Yes.
So I did want to ask you guys about the video content that you have on the HD benchmark disk. We talked a lot about the test patterns, which are all computer generated, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But then there's also a bunch of video clips. And I thought it was very nice to learn that you guys used the RED camera and actually shot all that stuff yourself.
Well, the main montage was definitely shot on the RED. Some of the other like interlaced clips were not.
Oh,
so that was other footage we acquired elsewhere. But the montage itself was shot 100% on the RED.
Mm-hmm. And did you shoot it in interlaced or progressive?
Shot progressive at 4K resolution. So 4096 by 2048.
I'm sorry, say that resolution again.
4096 by 2048. So a 2:1 aspect ratio.
Right. At 1080p 24, right? Or no, 4K 24. 24p.
Yeah. Yes.
And then you just down-res that to 1080p, right?
The basic edit was done in Final Cut Pro. Mm-hmm. And then we took an EDL or an edit decision list, which is just a text file with clip names and input and endpoints and outpoints. Mm-hmm. And then that was pulled into another high-end software package called Scratch, where I actually did all the color grading. So, you know, you make it blues where you want blue, green where you want green, et cetera. And then from there, we exported TIFFs out, 16-bit TIFFs that are 4K. And then we used our own software to scale it down to 1080p.
Mm-hmm. So it's on the disk at 1080p, or is it on the disk at 1080i?
It's on the disk at 1080p.
Okay. And what then? So the montage, I guess, is just there to see what the display or the player will do with real video content, right?
Yes, and they give you some, I guess,
and to provide,
like to say, oh, go ahead, Don.
I was just going to say, and to provide sort of a benchmark, Stacy, I think he's one of the experts, one of the sharpest people in the world about video encoding.
Yes.
What he doesn't know about video encoding isn't worth knowing. So, it was all encoded by Stacy taking the greatest care possible. It is absolutely pristine video. Pristine.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, one of the things I wanted to do was to push the bitrate as high as possible to sort of, if possible, to stress Blu-ray. So there are actual peaks in there during some of the crossfades that hit over 50 megabits per second.
Wow.
Even though the limit of Blu-ray is 40, you do have a 1 second buffer where you can kind of spike higher.
Really? So, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
But also shooting the video is a learning. Like there's a scene where you're looking at it's a long shot with a waterfall and then a building in the background. The building's in focus, but the waterfall's not. And that's because I shot it at f2.8. So it was kind of a slightly shallow depth of field.
Right.
That was just a rookie mistake.
Ah. Oh, you had intended the waterfall and the building both to be in focus.
Well,
you shouldn't give these things away, Stacy. Say, yeah, that was my artistic vision, was to have the waterfall
yes, the
out
artistic
of focus.
Vision. Okay, I like that. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And you're continuing to work with the RED camera?
Yeah, and so last summer, I actually drove up the Oregon coast and around Washington filming lighthouses. So I'm working on my own personal disc now that has about 22 lighthouses in it. So it's kind of a nature program. You sit down, 45 minutes, you've got soothing music in the background that my friend composed, and you just get to look at lighthouses. Hopefully somebody will buy it, but we'll see.
And then when you wake up, you can view the closing credits. And
I love the credits, by the way, on the... the mixed film and video tests on HD Benchmark, where you guys are the director and the producer and the grip and the catering.
So that footage there was also shot on the RED, and that we converted to interlaced. So I shot that. I don't remember if I shot that at a higher frame rate or not, because the RED is capable of shooting up to 120 frames per second at lower resolutions.
Ah, okay.
So you can shoot 4K at up to 30. You can shoot 3K up to 60 and 2K up to 120.
Oh, wow.
And it's for slow motion effects.
Right, right. So you shot that the footage behind the text at 120, did you say?
No, I don't remember what rate I shot that footage. It might have been at 60, so 3K at 60.
I see. Okay, anything else you guys want to say about the shooting or the anything else?
Buy the disc.
Buy the disc. All right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, listen, I think we have used up our time and no surprise there since you guys have so much to talk about. I want to thank Stacy Spears and Don Munsell. Their website is spearsandmunsell.com, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Yes.
Great. Yes. Where you can get HD Benchmark on Blu-ray. You didn't do it on DVD, did you?
No, just Blu-ray, although Don keeps, you know, saying, we should do a DVD.
Well, maybe so.
Why not?
Or why not? Yeah, or maybe a 3D one.
We've actually talked about doing a really simple DVD and then just giving it away on the website to try to bring people to the website.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a bonus thing.
Yeah, sounds like a great idea. Sounds like a great
idea. Make the ISO available for download, you know, so you could burn it yourself.
Sure, there you go. I like it. I encourage people to go visit spearsandmunsell.com. You can find me at ultimateavmag.com and hometheatermag.com, my online homes. Next week, the Geek of the Week is scheduled to be Mark Waldrop, a wonderful recording engineer I've known for many years, founder of AIX Records and a champion of multi-channel music. So I'm really looking forward to that. Again, Stacy and Don, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
You bet. And until next week then, geek out.